Hello, I'm Zoe Chi. This is number 0492, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0492. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, we remember Broadway legend Carol Channing, who passed away last week at the age of 97. We play part of an interview we did with her back in 2002.
I've never done a show that was written for me, and that's an actor's job. The thrill for me of being on the stage is to get into this character if I'm crazy about her. If you love that character enough, it descends on you and you've got her voice, you've got the way she walks, the way she talks, the way she sings and dances, and the way she thinks, and you get into her. People who want to be actors, that's their excitement in life.
Clinical forensic psychologist Dr. John Huber is back to talk about a study on how overuse of social media can lead to depression.
What we do know is, regardless of whether you're a man or a woman, if you spend 2 hours on social media, your body starts demonstrating behavioral symptoms for depression, male or female. That's what I'm going with now. I think it's relatively the same. The difference is I think women may be more likely to go and ask for help than men are, even in this situation.
Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabby, shares a slice of the Big Apple from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge. Among other things, he talks about the attempt to sterilize the deer population on Staten Island.
What they did is they put a program into effect that they were going to sterilize the male deer. Now, nobody ever really quite explained that. I mean, what do? You grab a deer and hold him down? They didn't get into the techniques of that. But anyway, whatever they're doing, it's not working. And they're having more deer than ever before. And they're also having more car crashes in which people get hurt because, you know, if you're in a car, if anybody's ever had it happen to them, and it happened to me once, you know, hitting a deer is like hitting a cement wall.
And we have lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later. The person who told you this was show number 0492 was Zoe Chi, program director for Astronomers Without Borders. You can find out more about what that fine organization does by going to their website at astronomerswithoutborders.org, and you'll find the link by going to our website at thestufffile.com, finding the show number for this page, which is 0492, which you just heard Zoe mention. So it all goes around full circle, much like the universe. Thank you very much, Zoe, for doing the guest lead on this edition of the Stuff File program, a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Miami Springs police say a woman stole her date's expensive watches and then bolted with the booty. During a jailhouse strip search shortly after, corrections officers found 4 Rolex watches inside her vagina. We'll get to the climax of this story in a moment, but let's deal with the fun facts along the way first, shall we? 29-year-old Delayuria Brookins of Northeast Miami-Dade met Orlando businessman Ramon Diaz one night at a popular nightclub called Mango's in Miami Beach. The couple later ended up at a hotel. After Diaz freshened up in the bathroom, he came back into the hotel room and noticed his Crown Royal whiskey bag containing 5 Rolex watches valued at about $108,000 gone. Brookins then dashed out of the room, went outside, and hailed a taxi. Before she could get into the cab, Diaz saw his whiskey bag inside her purse and demanded it back. Brookins then beat him on the head with an unknown object. Diaz became dazed and fell to the ground, according to the police. Meanwhile, a hotel employee called police. Cops swept the area and found Brookins, who, by the way, sports a tattoo on her left arm that reads, "Whore." Yeah. They found her in a nearby alley. Inside a police cruiser, Brookins spit, banged her head, stomped windows, and bit officers. Brookins was charged with grand theft, resisting an officer with violence, possession of cocaine, and battery. She was also charged with criminal mischief after she ticked off cops by urinating on the floor of her holding cell. During the arrest, police found one of Diaz's stolen watches. They searched the area nearby and couldn't find the other four, but during a jailhouse strip search, corrections officers recovered the rest, according to police. Four Rolex watches, which were found in Brookins' vaginal cavity. That's the quote. Yeah. Wow. Couldn't you just imagine a group of officers in a room with Brookins and one of them shouts out, "Shh! Quiet! Does anybody else hear that ticking?" This certainly brings new meaning to that famous John Cameron Swayze catchphrase.
Can certainly take a licking and keep on ticking.
Yes. Police raided an illegal gambling operation in Decatur, Alabama. They arrested 64-year-old Timothy Roberts and 67-year-old Donna Weir and confiscated 17 gambling machines. According to police, there was also video surveillance and electronic bells to warn of any police presence. I guess those bells didn't work as well in the long run. Roberts and Weir are being held on felony charges. Roberts, who was out on bail for allegedly running another illegal casino, had leased the entire office building and then rented out portions of it to other businesses, including the non-denominational Life Church. Wow. Who needs bingo when you have all of this? Talk about Our Lady of the Loaded Dice. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first segment here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, police in northern Texas say a woman has been banned from a local Walmart after she spent several hours driving an electric shopping cart around the store's parking lot while drinking wine from a Pringles can. Police say that officers responded to a report of a suspicious person around 9 a.m. at a Walmart in Wichita Falls. Wichita Falls police spokesperson Jeff Hughes says the woman had reportedly been riding the electric cart around the parking lot for about 3 hours. Hughes says police eventually found the woman in a nearby restaurant and told her not to return to the store. Ever. Okay, so let's do the math. She was caught at around 9 a.m. and she was riding the cart around the parking lot for about 3 hours. So that means her drinking started really, really early, no later than 6 a.m. By the way, is it white wine or red wine that goes with Pringles? Just asking. Anyway, let's get to our first segment here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Just recently, we lost an icon of the Broadway stage and a performer who was just an absolute joy to talk to. One of my favorite celebrity interviews of all time. I'm talking about actress Carol Channing. On January 15th, Carol died of natural causes at her home in Rancho Mirage, California, at the age of 97. I had the pleasure of talking to her not once, but twice back in 2002. Like Bookends, she was on the show with us at the beginning of the year and also at the end. Our first chat was on January 10th. Here's just part of that conversation now. Do you get the adrenaline rush when you go on stage and perform in front of an audience? Is that what gets you out there night after night?
Sheer panic will cause you to do anything. You can do the most wonderful things out of sheer panic.
After all these years of performing, do you still get a little stage fright on stage?
As I say, sheer panic. Yes.
So someone who was trained like yourself, who has done so many Broadway plays, you've also done some movies, is that a hurry-up-and-wait kind of situation? I mean, is it difficult for someone who is a stage performer to get in front of the camera where there's so much downtime?
Well, it's about as much as... So much what time? Downtime?
Yeah, there's not, you know, be setting up between shots and waiting for your scenes and...
Oh, yes, but I got to talk to Julie Andrews, and that was heaven. And I got to talk to Mary Tyler Moore, and we all became awfully good friends.
I guess we're talking about the film Thoroughly Modern Millie, correct?
That's right.
As a matter of fact, up here in the Montreal area, it played during the holidays, and I watched it again. I hadn't seen it in such a while. It was good to see that movie again.
I played Montreal.
When was that?
With Gentlemen Prefer Blondes,
mm-hmm.
and with Hello Dolly, and my one, oh, there was another one, Lorelei. And, oh, I love Montreal, but everybody does. There's nothing new about that.
Now, when you were performing on stage, again, you do something like Hello, Dolly for years and years and years. How do you keep it fresh?
No problem whatsoever. As I say, this is the audience. It's sheer panic before every audience. It's just, I mean, people say, oh, how are you, Carol? How's your son? And I think, what a heck of a time to ask me. We got to go on stage in a few minutes. And I just say, well, look, I can't answer you. You know, this could be the audience that never you don't communicate with. But I don't remember any. We really didn't. We always say after the show, but when they're good, lock all the doors and windows and don't let them out.
Now, I saw a quote some time ago that said, you said, I've been prostituting myself since the fourth grade.
Yes. Well, the reason is, you see, I have a book coming out. I wrote a book. Can you believe it? I wrote a book for Simon & Schuster. Michael Korda is my, he's my editor. And Chuck Adams. And but I wrote it all myself. And I thought, what should I call this? And I remember that, you know, the old joke, what's a nice girl like you, the client to the prostitute, what's a nice girl like you doing in a place like this? And the prostitute says, just lucky, I guess. But it's interesting that when you do it on stage, I've been prostituting myself since the fourth grade. I mean, when you do it on stage, I wanted to win the election so I could read the minutes to the school. Every Friday, and nobody much cared whether they were accurate or not, as long as they were entertaining. So I got that. Isn't that marvelous training?
So you had the acting bug from a very early age.
Seven. Yes.
There was no doubt that this was what you were going to do?
No doubt.
Now, how did your parents feel when you said, you know, I want to go into acting?
Oh, I said that. I told both my parents, and my father said, you know, those are the happier people. The one, not the people who get out of work, but those the ones who find their work. And I never got off the track. I never tried to do anything else.
I also understand you went to school not too far from us here in Montreal. You went to school in Vermont?
That's right, Bennington.
Yeah.
Oh, boy, the best skiing country in the world. I don't know. I haven't tried it all over the world.
Are you a skier, or were you a skier?
No.
No.
No. They kept us busy up there at Bennington. No, but it is the best skiing country. No, all I did was play Montreal.
Okay. Now, when it comes to your big performance that everyone knows you for, which is Hello, Dolly, that was such a smash hit that played for years on Broadway. Were you disappointed when you didn't get a chance to play the role in the movies?
Oh, certainly. Oh, yes. I thought the movie was terrible. Naturally, I would. No, we were good friends, Barbara Streisand and I. And then all of a sudden, I got on my high horse and got mad.
Why didn't you get the part on the screen?
You know, I don't know. They didn't want Gower Champion either. And he choreographed the scenery and the flowers and the closet door and the everything. It was the remarkable thing about Dolly was the teamwork of it. It was Jerry Herman's music and lyrics, and Mike Stewart. It was everybody involved in it.
Do you think that there was still, at that time, a bit of a stigma between those who act on stage and those who act on screen and Never the Twain Shall Meet?
No, I know. You see, it was a smash hit, Dolly. It really was. They had jokes in magazines about a dying man sitting up in bed saying, and I do bequeath my two tickets to Hello, Dolly, too, you know, and all that, as he's dying.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just, and gondoliers in Venice singing Hello, Dolly, going down those waterways and all. It was just a smash hit until the producers. We got more publicity from the producers. They said nothing ever received the Tony Awards like Hello, Dolly, until the producers came along and they beat it by two.
Now, I know you, with the exception of the performance that you had with Jerry Herman in November that you really haven't performed for about 4 years. Is that correct?
Yes, I deliberately went into hibernation to write this book. And it's memoirs. And you have to, if you want to write a book all by yourself, you just have to, and it's the loneliest life in the world. So here I sit in the middle of a monastery, like it looks like it. And I just keep writing, but it's, you have to warm up to the people you're writing about. That's the only way out. Otherwise, you go insane.
Yeah.
So I just visited with everybody I was writing about.
What was your favorite part?
The last one I was in. I can't, you know, it's like being in love. You can't remember any other boyfriend. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Now,
it was Hello, Dolly.
Okay. Now, you made your Broadway debut, if I am correct, in 1948 in No For an Answer. Is that right?
Yes. No, my Broadway debut was before then. It was fresh out of Bennington, and Mark Blitzstein wrote one comedy review. You know, he wrote modern American operas.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote The Cradle Will Rock. And this was called No For an Answer. And it was the one comedy song, I'm Simply Fraught About You. And he said, yes, I want you. I auditioned for it. No, that was way back before, when was that? In the 40s, after World War II. Not World War I, but World War II.
Now, people hear about your career and all the things that you've done, and they get the impression that, you know, you just sailed through life. It was all very, very easy. But it's tough getting on Broadway, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. When people ask me, do you think I'm good enough to be on Broadway and all that, like, even if you can ask that question, I don't think you'll ever make it. You just have to keep going after it and being fired and being ignored and being told you're too tall or your voice is too low or some darn thing. And then finally, but if you just keep at it beyond all sanity and beyond all health and everything, and something is something has to be driving you.
And at no point when you were getting all this rejection did you ever decide, or even just a hint of, maybe some of these people are right, maybe I should just go back home?
Well, I didn't think I was going to make it, but see, the younger generation is much taller, so they're just about my height now. So I'm all right, I can start all over again.
Yeah, when you came along, you mentioned, you know, your voice is a little deeper. You were taller than most of the young gals who were out there at the time. You weren't the stereotypical Ziegfeld girl, I guess, when you first came along.
Who is in the theater?
That's true.
Yeah, nobody. I just keep meeting one of a kind all the time.
I guess that makes it easy for them to come up with the right show for you, because it doesn't compare with anybody else. Although I know, in talking with Jerry Herman when he was on the program with us, that, of course, Hello, Dolly, when it was first conceived, was not for you.
No, it wasn't. No, I've never done a show that was written for me.
Really?
Never. No. And that's an actor's job, you know? I mean, the thrill of for me of being on the stage is to get into this character if I'm crazy about her.
So when somebody else creates a character for somebody else, how do you, Carol Channing, make it your own?
Obie, you go into your closet, Julie Andrews, and it says in the Bible, go into your closet, keep your channel open. And you close the door and keep your channel open. Now, Martha Graham said that to her dance class, too. It's in the Bible. And you go in, and by golly, if you love that character enough, it descends on you, and you've got her voice, you've got the way she walks, the way she talks, the way she sings and dances, and the way she thinks, and you get into her. And the people who want to be actors, that's their excitement in life.
Now, when people go to see a Broadway show, do they want to see Carol Channing absorbed by a character on stage, or do they want to see Carol Channing?
I'm unaware of the fact that there is a Carol Channing. I'll bet if anybody asked you, tell me, who are you, Peter Holder, you know? That you would describe somebody that you kind of wish you were, or something else, and have it all off, and your friends would all say, oh, for heaven's sakes, that's not you. But if you're coming through at all, you've got to. No, if you do honest work artistically in any of the arts, you recreate yourself and don't know it. Here's your answer.
Did you ever think when you first started on the Broadway stage that you'd reach to the point where you are now with all the accolades that you've accomplished and all the awards that you've won, that you would be the icon that you are today? Did you dream about that when you first got on Broadway?
I'm totally unaware of that. Totally unaware. See, I've always wished I could go down the center aisle in the theater and say, now, which part did you like the best, the first act or the second act? Well, why did you like it? Blah, blah, blah. And I never get to talk to the audience. So how do I know? You don't know whether you're popular with your listeners or not. I'm totally unaware of anything like that. And I noticed that Lynn Fontana and Alfred Lund, now you're too young, I can tell by your voice, to know who they were, but they were the oracles of modern acting and modern, everything to do with the theater and live theater. And they had no idea that they would dim the lights all over the world when Alfred died and when she died. Lynn said to me, I had no idea. Alfred had no idea. They just kept, see, you've got the next audience to capture, and you might lose them. It's like walking a tightrope. You may never communicate with them. That next audience is always in front of you.
One of the great things about Broadway is, of course, there are great shows on the boards on most of the theaters that are there. Yet, no matter how many crowds they get, and even if they're sold out, night after night after night, the reality is that most of North America will never have the opportunity to actually see a Broadway play unless those plays tour. Did you enjoy touring?
I did, and I toured all over Canada, all over the United States. We went from Vancouver straight across. I've so many times gone I guess there are about five different tours of different shows. Dolly was three times.
Mm-hmm. Do the audiences differ from place to place?
Yes, they used to more than they do now. I'm a person who, I should have put that in my book. Because if you go south of the Mason-Dixon line, everything your character does is sweet. And no matter what, if they like you, you are sweet. You are just dear and sweet and feminine and all that. And then you get up north in Detroit, and all of a sudden they see the gangster side of Lorelei Lee, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And they see and there are all sides to a character, and to all of us, we aren't one cylinder, and they only see what their standards are. It's interesting. But the timing, the laughs are there, they're the same, and the tears are there, and it's still there, but they change your character for you.
Really?
Yeah, they do. They you can just feel it. There's a terrific response to sweetness in the South, and there's a terrific response to being durable and tough, and you can get through it, and you're going to make it. Reach for the pot of the end of the rainbow, and you're going to make it, you know? They feel that ambition of the character, that side of her, and they make it come to life.
That was Carol Channing, who passed away on January 15th at her home in Rancho Mirage, California. She was 97 years old, and she was an absolute delight to talk to. A funny, smart, and talented lady. Her book, which is still available, is called Just Lucky, I Guess, a memoir of sorts. And speaking of books, it's because of people like Carol Channing, and also because of the encouragement of her publicist, Harlan Bowl, that I wrote my book, Great Conversations, My Interviews with Two Men on the Moon and a Galaxy of Stars. Carol was one of the first stars I wrote about after it was Harlan who put the idea in my head that I might have a book in me. Harlan and I reminisced about some of the many clients of his that I had spoken to over the years, and I got a warm feeling talking about my various chats with Carol. In a way, she's kind of responsible for my writing a book in the first place. For many reasons, she will be missed. And Stuff File program fans, you can hear full versions of both conversations I had with Carol Channing by going to our Patreon page and becoming one of the select patrons of the show. Carol shares stories about her family life, her battle with cancer while she was performing on Broadway, and more. Just go to patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to The Stuff File Program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File Program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. This is The Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder. This broadcast is coming to you from upstairs. Get out of the house.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about social media and depression. Plus, Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabby, shares a slice of the Big Apple from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge. We do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way, and much more Stuff File news here on the Stuff File program, which is heard everywhere, including on Stitcher and TuneIn, and can also be heard via Google Play and iTunes. Just click on the Google Play or iTunes button located on the website at thestufffile.com, and whichever platform you listen to for this program, please feel free to leave a review of the show on their site. It would be greatly appreciated. Well, let's get back to the stuff. A man in Ireland ended up in the hospital after injecting himself with monthly doses of his own semen in an attempt to cure chronic back pain. It is the first documented case of semen injection for medical treatment, according to a report published in the Irish Medical Journal. According to the journal, the patient disclosed that he had intravenously injected his own semen as an innovative method to treat back pain. He had devised this cure independent of any medical advice. Over the course of a year and a half, the man reportedly self-administered the injections on a monthly basis. As a result, he developed a bacterial skin infection and an abscess under the skin of his right forearm, which doctors discovered after a physical exam when he arrived in hospital complaining of severe lower back pain. Doctors immediately administered antimicrobial treatment. His back pain decreased during his hospital visit, and the man discharged himself before doctors could make an incision to drain the local collection. As a result of the man's visit, researchers conducted a review of medical journals for mention of intravenous semen injection for back pain treatment and other maladies. They found no supporting research conducted on humans, but found a report on the effects of semen injections for rats and rabbits. The case at least highlights the dangers of untrained people using needles, the report said, and the hazards involved with injecting substances into your veins that are not intended for that purpose. Okay, I know you have a lot of questions. I know I do. How did this clown get this idea? How much of his semen did he collect to inject into his own body over that period of time? Did he inject it just into his arm, or was he trying to find a vein? Did he share this idea with anybody else? And if so, why didn't any sane person try to talk him out of it? I could go on and on and on, but suffice to say, this man is a moron. Okay, frantic zookeepers rushed to call an ambulance after a vet shot a tranquilizer dart at a man dressed as a gorilla. Police on the Spanish island of Tenerife received a call from a panicked member of the public who said that a gorilla had escaped from its pen in Laura Park Zoo and was seen running around the theme park. A vet was called and, on spotting the creature, fired a tranquilizer dart into its leg with enough sedative to fell a 450-pound beast. To his horror, the vet, who had only been on the job for about 2 months, let's see how long he keeps that job, realized that the creature was in fact an employee of the zoo dressed in a gorilla suit who was staging a mock escape to practice their emergency routines. Well, now we know how those emergency routines will work. The 35-year-old man was taken to the island's university hospital after the shooting. He was said to be in a serious condition, having suffered an allergic reaction to the tranquilizer, but was expected to make a full recovery. Good thing this story happened in Spain. I mean, in some countries, they may have used real bullets. You know, that zoo employee is going to hold it over the head of that vet for the rest of his life. If they ever have conversations or arguments in the future, all the guy has to yell to win is, "Yeah, but you shot me with a tranquilizer gun!" Yeah. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, Coast Guard crews in Auckland, New Zealand, responded to a report of an explosion on a boat just off of Motu Island. According to a paramedic by the name of Chris Deacon, in a quote that I just love, the boat owner smelt gas and confirmed that there was gas by lighting a match, which is a very tried and true method of finding gas. Unfortunately, it is not a very good method. Amazingly, the man in his 60s suffered only superficial injuries. The Coast Guard used the opportunity to remind boaters to use safer methods to check their fuel supplies and apply common sense. Now, isn't that a catch-22? A vicious cycle. I mean, if you have to tell people that they need to apply common sense, then aren't you talking to people who don't know how to apply common sense? Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? A new study from the University of Essex and University College London finds that teenagers who spend more hours a day on social media have a greater risk of depression, and the connection appears to be particularly pronounced for girls. To talk about this, we have back on the program clinical forensic psychologist Dr. John Huber. He's the chairman for Mainstream Mental Health, which is a nonprofit organization. John joins us on the line from Texas. Hi, John.
Hello, Peter. Thank you for having me today.
Always a pleasure to have you on the program. So this study talking about social media and teenagers, first of all, the idea that it seems to be worse for girls than boys, is that something that your general knowledge of mental health would seem to ring true, or do you think more study is needed in that?
Well, I think more study is needed in that. We know a few things. You know, they have for decades reported that depression is more prevalent in girls than in boys, and women than in men. But then when we started looking closer at it, we found out that women were more likely to report having depression, and men had different symptoms, like anger and aggression was a symptom of depression. They would get mad at the world, and they wouldn't necessarily go to a doctor and say, "I'm depressed." They would end up in court needing anger management classes. So my thought is it's probably not that much different between the two genders. It's just manifesting itself in slightly different ways.
Generally speaking, when you see a study like this come out, are you grateful for the fact that there is information out there? Or conversely, are you concerned about the fact that maybe just publicizing these types of things can sometimes be much ado about nothing? And that we are highlighting something that really isn't necessarily a strong issue here?
Well, I think anytime, you know, as chairman of Mainstream Mental Health, anytime we can get the topic on the table and have a discussion about mental health issues, I'm excited about it. I'm happy for it. Unfortunately, with that comes the bad part when they hook on something that is maybe not the most salient thing or most important thing we should be focusing on and create a bigger problem by focusing on that, which this may be doing by saying females are much more susceptible. What we do know is, regardless of whether you're a man or a woman, if you spend 2 hours on social media, your body starts demonstrating behavioral symptoms for depression, male or female. So, you know, that's what I'm going with now. I think it's relatively the same. The difference is I think women may be more likely to go and ask for help than men are, even in this situation.
In how these stories are published and how they're focused, because it's one thing to show a study. It's another thing for that study to be then taken by the media, like myself, for instance, and talking about it or writing about it in a form that tilts it toward one direction. And the reason why I bring that up is if it's a clinical study that just barely states the facts, it doesn't necessarily either vindicate or condemn social media. It just points out what the facts are. And the reason why I bring that up is, isn't social media like anything else a conduit for something that may already be a stressor or for the person who is using it? Go back to when we were kids and everyone would say, you know, television is going to ruin us all, sitting in front of the television too long. Is it the makeup of the personality who is sitting in front of the television or using social media, or is it television or social media that's causing the problem?
Well, television had its own problems, and social media has different problems. You know, when, think about it, you're walking down a hallway and you see one of your friends. The first thing you do, you smile at each other, you make eye contact, and you get close enough, you shake hands, you maybe hug, pat each other on the back. This whole process, your body starts releasing all these different hormones in your system, including oxytocin, norepinephrine, all this type of stuff, and it nourishes you emotionally that way. When we get on social media and you click on a like one of your friend's posts, or your friend clicks on a like for one of your posts, the only thing you're getting is a little bit of a dopamine burst. And in fact, it has the exact same cycle and process as somebody doing heroin. You don't get any of the other neurotransmitters, but that little bit of dopamine, as not as intense as the heroin drug use, but it makes you feel a little bit better. And then all of a sudden, a little while later, you start craving that dopamine again. And a real simple way to fix it is to go back on social media. In the meantime, you're not getting all those other neurotransmitters that heal us and nurture us emotionally. So in essence, what we're doing is we're taking a diet soda that tastes sweet and fills our stomach, that has absolutely no nutritional value, and we're using that as a meal replacement plan, and we are starving nutritionally with it for everything else. And that's what's happening with us neuropsychologically in this situation. So it is different than television, and it has its own problems associated with it. The other thing with that is we had decades, you know, when we had one, two, maybe three channels. And then all of a sudden we had an extra, the UHF channels, we had three or four more. And then in the 70s, we got cable, and now we had 20, then 32, then 50. Now we got over 300 channels. We've had decades to process and learn to adapt and cope. We've had 12 years with these. Smartphones were invented in 2007. Within a year, all these social media apps started popping up. We have not adjusted yet. We are in the process of doing that. And, you know, we talk about this. I believe we're resilient. I believe we will adjust and overcome. And, you know, just like they said, Elvis will ruin us through television. You know, we survived Elvis. We will survive this.
It can part of the situation and part of the problem be age related. I know we started talking about teenagers, but you just said it took us a period of time to try and get our heads around social media as compared to what television has done over the series of decades. Is it possible that younger people can adapt much more quickly to the use of social media as someone who is older, not even as old as myself, just say a millennial, the changes that take place within social media from year to year?
That may be what's happening, because I don't see other problems that we see in the millennials with the upcoming generations behind them. When I go in to work with middle school and elementary and some high school students, I'm not seeing all those problems. The millennials have had a difficult time. Half of them come from helicopter parents. They haven't learned coping skills. Their social interactions on social media have limited their ability to learn those coping skills, and we know one in five attempt suicide right now. So there is a lot of things happening, but I think the younger generations, you may be onto something right there. The little people, the middle school, elementary school, maybe some of the high school kids now, they've been in there long enough that they've started adjusting and making these shifts. And it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. You know, again, I like to look at the data instead of what I think is happening emotionally. You know, like, hey, I want this to happen, I want that to happen, so I'm going to talk about it. No, I have to, my forensic training says, go back and look at the data. And the data points to this stimulus response dopamine mechanism as being part and parcel to the main problem of social media. And we've seen that in different things, typically drugs, cigarettes, alcoholism, things like that. Not everybody becomes an alcoholic. Not everybody becomes a drug addict. So what is it in an individual or a society that helps prevent that and fight that? And you, again, may be onto something with that evolution that's happening with our younger generation.
Well, as you said earlier, you are thankful for when such reports like this come out. Someone like yourself, who is a trained professional, when these stories come out and they make their way to magazines, newspapers, and the like, what is, should I, as a layperson and the rest of the community who are not professionals like yourself, what should we take away from a story like this?
Well, first thing you should realize is that it's becoming a big enough problem that it's hitting the mainstream media. And that should be right there, because you know, you've got a lot of powerful people, whether they're Amazon, whether it's Instagram, Snapchat, who have a lot vested in this being an okay thing to do. And they have lots of money behind them right now. So they could easily put a lot of pressure and shut some of this stuff down. So the fact that it's hitting that mainstream media, I think, should be a red flag. Hey, I need to pay attention to this. I need to get more research. I need to get more data. And parents and older people who aren't as adept at using social media, you know, I'm not saying you don't use it and use it a lot, but you're not as skilled as some of these kids because they live it. They've seen it their whole life, and we haven't. We should use the same technology that is causing the problem to help fix it. And there's already some really nice little apps out there to help parents. Some cost an annual service between $1 and $2 a month per child that you're monitoring, and they will stay on top of all your data. They will tell you how much time your kids are spending. There's even some software out there that will say, hey, your child has started using language that is typical of language used by depressed people. So you can start, wait, maybe something's happening with my kid, and I need to go look at that. So use the technology.
Fascinating stuff indeed. Always a pleasure to have you on the program, sir.
Well, Peter, thank you. It's always great to be on your show. It's so refreshing, and I just love being part of it.
Dr. John Huber, Chairman for Mainstream Mental Health. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0492, and you'll find links to John's site. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. It probably wouldn't surprise you to hear that Harvard Law School has produced almost twice as many U.S. Supreme Court justices as any other law school. Its reputation for training brilliant lawyers is well known, so when I visited Harvard recently, I made it a point to tour its law library. Located just north of historic Harvard Yard, the library contains statues and tributes to some of its most distinguished alumni, and I was happy to see that one of them honors my favorite judge, Learned Hand. That's right. His name was Learned Hand, and what an appropriate name it was. He was a respected federal judge, and while he never served on the Supreme Court, his opinions have been quoted more often in Supreme Court opinions than those of any other lower court judge. Let's be fair, that's certainly praiseworthy, but he's my favorite judge because he once said, and I quote, "Litigation is to be dreaded beyond almost anything short of sickness or death," unquote. A smart man indeed. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamericatv.org.
Latitude, 47 degrees, 14 minutes north. Longitude, 84 degrees, 39 minutes west. Location, Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Now, the
Stuff File presents The Gabby Cabbie, direct from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge in the city that never sleeps, New York. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And from the mean streets of New York, we do indeed have Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabbie from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge. Hello, sir.
Hello, hello, live from the beautiful, kind of nippy streets of New York.
Yes, it is kind of cold out there these days. Now, I happened to see a video of this last week that I found very interesting. It was the Tappan Zee Bridge in New York was imploded into the Hudson River, and that got a lot of attention. Is anybody talking about it in your cab, or did you happen to see it yourself?
No, I didn't see it myself, but it's been a very big topic of conversation, and it raises a lot of interesting side stories. First of all, there's many people who right away from the beginning said it was never necessary to do it. There was nothing wrong with the bridge, and that this whole, the old bridge, and that this was just a great way for a lot of people to make a lot of money by getting rid of the bridge and then building a new one, sort of the ultimate goal of every politician to make a bundle. So there's that controversy right there. Now they decide that they couldn't take it down piece by piece, so they blew it up. And as that turned out to be a disaster, first of all, it's left the Hudson River as a big mess with all kinds of crap floating around in it. They're claiming now that thousands, maybe millions of fish have been killed. So the environmentalists are going berserk over the whole thing. And so we've ended up with a bridge that's cost millions and millions of dollars, served no purpose other than naming it after the father of the governor.
Okay, but
now you'd say that's kind of simplistic, but that's
okay. But let's go back in history. Let's go back in history a little bit. The name of the official name of the old bridge was also named after a governor. So
yeah,
I'm just wondering. The original name of the bridge was the Governor Malcolm Wilson Tappan Zee Bridge, and everyone just called it the Tappan Zee Bridge. So now the official name of this new bridge is the Governor Mario M. Cuomo Bridge. I wouldn't be surprised if in the vernacular, people still call it the Tappan Zee Bridge, so.
Okay, no, you're right about that. You hit the nail right on the head. As a matter of fact, we have the Edward Koch Bridge, which is still called the 59th Street Bridge. We have the Triborough Bridge, which has been named after Bobby Kennedy, but nobody calls that. We have 125th Street in Harlem, which is called Martin Luther King Boulevard. Nobody calls it that. No, that's one thing about New Yorkers. We'll have the names. And as you probably know, and just as a little side tip for all your listeners, every school in New York City is called PS35, PS44, PS55. They all have names, but nobody uses it. I guess we're not big on names in New York.
Mm. Meanwhile, I understand your mayor, Mayor Bill de Blasio, has pledged to make New York the first city in the nation to require private employers to provide at least 2 weeks of paid vacation to all employees. Now, as you know, I'm living up here in Canada, and everyone up here is saying, and the big deal about this is?
Well, the big deal is that we're going to do it here, and you guys have already had such kinds of social programs. But the fact of the matter is that the classic example of politicians who are not business people, except, I guess, for Trump, who go ahead and come up with these cockamamie schemes without realizing the ramifications. I can guarantee you that 5 minutes after he announced that, an unending list of companies in New York City said, okay, we're leaving, goodbye, that's it, we can't afford it. Or we're not going to hire as many people. It's the same fight that everybody gets into when it comes to the minimum wage. There's a very thin line between social programs and putting people out of business. I, for one, I think it's a great idea to have a vacation. I think two is not even really fair in a way. I grew up being in the military where it's 4 weeks. So, and that's kind of a reasonable amount. So if you asked me, would I vote for the 2 week vacation or even a 4 week vacation? Yeah, I would, but from a practical point of view, it's a disaster.
Mm. Meanwhile, I understand an art museum that specializes in artworks depicting dogs is returning to New York City more than 30 years after its founding. What's the story about art literally going to the dogs?
Yeah, well, New York is very big on dogs. People don't realize it because you don't see dog do all over the place. And the reason you don't see it all over the place, New York is very strict. They get monstrous fines. And if you weren't to pick up after your dog in New York City, you'd have somebody yelling, hey, hey, buddy, come on, pick up after your dog. Come on, pick it up. So New Yorkers are getting very well trained. Also, it's a tremendous social instrument in New York City. The guy walks the dog, the girl walks the dog, depending on what their sexual persuasion is. And the leashes get intertwined, and the next thing you know, they're married. You know, so it's a good way of meeting people because, you know, it's hard to walk up to somebody on the street and say, hello, my name is Peter, can I take you out for a drink? It's a lot easier to say, oh, what a cute little doggy you have. What kind is it? What is his name? You know, and then the rest is history. So having the fact that this museum is going again is not unusual, but it's kind of classic New York. We are the Big Apple, and the apple is the symbol of New York City, but if you wanted a secondary symbol, it would be the dog.
And I understand this museum, is the Museum of the Dog, will debut featuring one of the largest canine art collections in the world. Now, I assume that means it's artwork depicting dogs, not artwork done by dogs, right?
Yeah, no, but if somebody can have it done by dogs. I myself, in our family and with the children growing up, we always had dogs and we always had cats, so we were definitely a pet-friendly family. But as far as the artwork goes, that's of no interest to me. I mean, if I want a dog, I want to be able to pet it. I don't want to look at a picture of a dog. Mm.
So we'll go from, as you said earlier, the mating habits of people who have dogs to the mating habits of deer. I guess people aren't, when you think of places like New York and the boroughs and places like Staten Island, you don't necessarily think that there's wildlife there. But there, I understand there's deer in Staten Island, and the problem is the number of deer. What are they planning on doing about this?
Yeah, well, here's the deal. We have five boroughs in New York City, the Bronx, Brooklyn, Queens, Manhattan, and Staten Island. Staten Island being the most rural because one of the ways of getting there is by a ferry. And another way is by getting there by a bridge. So it's a little isolated from the other four boroughs. And it has a lot of animals, and it has a lot of deer. And as a matter of fact, what they did is they put a program into effect that they were going to sterilize the male deers. Now, nobody ever really quite explained that. I mean, what do? You grab a deer and hold him down? You know, they didn't get into the techniques of that. You probably will have to have a veterinarian on after me. But anyway, whatever they're doing, it's not working. And they're having more deer than ever before. And they're also having more car crashes in which people get hurt. So far, nobody's gotten killed, luckily, because, you know, if you're in a car, or if anybody's ever had it happen to them, and it happened to me once, you know, hitting a deer is like hitting a cement wall. So it's a very clear and present danger. And I guess they're going to have to get a better veterinarian to work the project.
Mm. I've been watching Ray Donovan. You know, he's in Staten Island these days. Maybe he can do something about the deer population.
Yeah, well, you see, now the most wanted killer is Bambi.
Absolutely. And finally, some restaurants in New York, I understand, are giving a bit of a savings by having some off-peak hour prices.
Yeah, well, you know, that's a gimmick, I think, and I've always thought it's very unfair. We don't do it in the taxi industry. It's not legal to do it. So, in other words, if it happens to be raining outside, I can't charge you more money, or at certain hours, I can't. On the other hand, Uber and Lyft and those kind of companies play that game, which is really exploiting the public. So now the restaurants have said, that's a good idea. We'll give bargain prices at 3 in the morning, but at 6 p.m. we'll charge more for your steak. I got some mixed emotions about it because, as I say, I think it's taking advantage of the situation. And in many instances when that happens, it's illegal. I mean, for instance, as I talk to you now, there's some question of us having a slight snowstorm, which means a lot of the stores will start charging more money for shovels and the ice salt stuff and that. That's illegal in New York City. You can't really do it. So I don't think the restaurant idea is a good thing. I think it's going to antagonize people.
Well, maybe what we can do is combine the last two stories, and maybe the restaurants could save a little money by selling venison.
Yeah, which I happen to find kind of tough, but that probably not stop anybody from eating it.
Even though there's a snowstorm on the way, I understand that you're still out there working as you always do. And should someone decide to be in New York during the time that the snow is falling, they can still enjoy one of the tours that you offer. People can go to your website at gabby.com to find out more about it. People can send you an email to peter@gabby.com. Peter, I thank you as always for being on the program with us.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about a racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. We have time for one more item, and you know what that is, boys and girls? Yes, it's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
This week's item seems to be a recurring issue in Stuff File news and is kind of close to one just 2 weeks ago involving a handcuffed hitchhiker. In this one, which comes to us from the province of Alberta and was brought to my attention by listener Shell Beckwith, thanks Shell, a woman and two men are in custody after they approach police in a vehicle filled with drugs, asking for help because they had run out of gas. The trio were arrested after an afternoon traffic stop, but they weren't the ones who were pulled over. According to the RCMP, the vehicle pulled over in front of the police and a woman exited the vehicle wanting help because she had run out of gas. As officers chatted with her and provided her with assistance, they discovered that she was wanted on an outstanding warrant. Then police found two men in the vehicle trying to hide who were also wanted on outstanding warrants. One of the men was in medical distress and was transported to hospital by ambulance. Officers searched the vehicle and found almost 1 kilogram of what is believed to be methamphetamine and 85 grams of what is believed to be cocaine. Oh, and the vehicle was stolen. The woman and two men are in custody and are now facing a multitude of charges. Now, why, oh why, would you, as a felon, pull up to police officers in a stolen car filled with drugs and two other felons, one of which needs medical attention, to ask for gasoline? One reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0492. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0492. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. We leave you with this deep question to ponder. Who did we compare babies to before Winston Churchill?